93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hayden.
It was sort of alarming going through their catalog just to realize how old they are and or how storied they are. I mean, that they, by the time of that record, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, like that was their first of several major sort of reinventions and major pivots. You know, I don't think there's a band, the current band, that's had as many phases.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93XFM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hayden. My guest this week is a really smart and great writer. His name is Rob Harvella. He's a writer for The Ringer. You may also know him from Spin or Deadspin or The Village Voice. And we're going to be talking about something I never thought we would cover on this podcast, the Red Hot Chili Peppers. We're going to talk about that. And then we're also going to talk about sort of the evolution of 90s rock into classic rock and how history has sort of been rewritten in the process of that. It's a really fun conversation, and I'm excited to share it. Before we get to that, though, I want to give a shout-out to our sponsor of this week's episode. It's our old friends at Mack Weldon. And Mack Weldon, look, they make really comfortable shirts, underwear, all sorts of undergarments. And it's a company that I use, and I really love their shirts. They have shirts of all colors. They're really well made. They're really comfortable. It's really great clothes to wear in the summertime. And, you know, the reason why it works so well is that they believe in smart design, premium fabrics, and it's also really easy to buy. All you do is basically you just go online to their website. That's MackWeldon.com, and you pick what you want, and all the products are great. And to encourage you to buy these clothes, as if imagining me wearing these clothes is not enough, I have a special deal for you. What you need to do is you just go to MackWeldon.com, and when you are at the checkout, you put in the promo code ROCK. And when you do that, you will get 20% off of your order. So again, you go to MackWeldon.com, you pick out some great clothes, and when you're at the checkout, enter the promo code ROCK, and you will get 20% off of your order. And when you do that, they'll know that you heard about Mack Weldon from this podcast. So not only are you going to get great clothes, but it's a great way to support what we're doing here, because without our sponsors, we couldn't continue to do this podcast. So please go to MackWeldon.com and buy some great clothes. So, as I said before, our guest this week is Rob Harvella, and I wanted to have Rob on because he recently wrote a really great piece for The Ringer about the Red Hot Chili Peppers, sort of looking at the totality of their career as well as their latest record, The Getaway. But what I was really interested in to talk about with Rob is sort of the evolution of classic rock. You know, like when I was growing up, it was Led Zeppelin, The Who, Styx, Boston, bands like that. But now we're seeing a shift toward bands like the Chili Peppers, Green Day, Foo Fighters, Smashing Pumpkins. And it's an interesting transition that has sort of shaped how subsequent generations look at that era. And I thought Rob would be a good guy to talk to about that. And of course he was. We had a great conversation. And here it is. Well, hey, Rob, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's fun to talk to you. I think we have only like G-chatted in the past.
I know. We're just internet acquainted.
Exactly.
That's the way it goes, I guess. So it's, you know, I know your voice well at this point, but it's good to be actually talking to you.
Well, you know, the reason I started this podcast is so I would have an excuse to talk to people that I only G-chat with. So
there we go. I'm sure there's a lot of those.
Because otherwise I'd be like, well, you know, I want to call Rob, but, you know, he's on deadline and I'd be bothering him.
Yeah.
But now
this is a good professional excuse to just bullshit.
Exactly.
I get it.
It's like a smoke break, but we're recording it.
There we go.
So the reason I wanted to talk to you, there's a couple reasons I wanted to talk to you, but let's start with, you wrote a piece, it will have run a couple of weeks in the past by the time this podcast runs. You wrote about the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and the Chili Peppers have a new record, it's called The Getaway, and but your piece kind of takes in the totality of the Chili Peppers experience. It's a deep dive into their catalog. And I have to say that when I read your piece, it spoke to me because it actually reminded me that I used to like the Chili Peppers. at a time in my life. Because they're a band now that is very easy to use as a punchline. You know, like I've done it many times myself. They're easy to make fun of. They're a band that if I were to rank these things, that I think they're among the worst bands in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They seem like one of the worst sort of major 90s bands to me. But reading your piece, I wouldn't say you were kind to the Chili Peppers, but you were thoughtful about it. And in particular, like, you reminded me about Blood Sugar Sex Magik, which is sort of like, probably still like the emblematic record of their career. And
Definitely. And
that definitely was like a sleepover classic in the early, like if you're sleeping over at a buddy's house or you're playing basketball in their driveway. If you were doing that in 91, 92, Blood Sugar Sex Magik was probably in the mix at some point.
Yeah. Well, I think the one thing in that piece, my wife, a story I always loved and my wife tells, is that she would do sleepovers during that period. And there was one classmate of hers who would watch the Under the Bridge video and would watch and rewind and watch and rewind the portion where Anthony Kiedis is running in slow motion, like during the last chorus. And like, in my recollection, the girl was also crying with like lust or whatever. And I think I may have actually invented that part, unfortunately, but yeah, that seemed to me to be a good sort of image to encapsulate the Red Hot Chili Peppers at the time. I mean, that was a huge record, it was like a junior high homeroom classic kind of record. And I don't think I owned it, and I wouldn't have said that I was a fan of the band, but I did. I was glad that they were around. I think they were necessary. You know, when you think about the early 90s heroes and how glum they were, and how self-loathing and how like you had to be a rock star, but be like tortured about it and conflicted about it. And you weren't supposed to want the things you wanted and the things that you had. And just the Red Hot Chili Peppers felt, so fun and so uncomplicated, and just not at all at peace with themselves, and their environment, and their wardrobe, it was just nice to have people out there who just seemed like they were enjoying themselves.
Right.
Genuinely, because I was in surprisingly short supply back then.
Yeah, I mean, they were sort of the closest thing to like a Van Halen of the early 90s, like a party band, like an unpretentious party band that you could just enjoy. And yeah, there wasn't all of this baggage about, or this sort of, brow furrying about being a rock star and selling out. Like, it just seemed like the Chili Peppers, in a way, they had alternative cred, but they also seemed more like an arena rock band.
I mean, well, first of all, like, I knew intuitively that prior to Blood Sugar Sex Magik, like, they'd had a full career, but I was shocked when I went back and listened to all those records. And their self-titled album came out in 1984.
Right.
Which is just completely shocking to me. Like, it doesn't compute at all to regard them as that is like the same year as Purple Rain is born in the USA, as Double Nickels on the Dime. Like, it was sort of alarming going through their catalog just to realize how old they are and or how storied they are. I mean, that they, by the time of that record, Blood Sugar Sex Magik, like that was their first of several major sort of reinventions and major pivots. You know, I don't think there's a current band that's had as many phases, Even U2, who is always like trying to present themselves as like the next phase, like it's a more natural progression. It's a really sort of bizarre and convoluted path that they've taken, but just I could not believe that they were like a mid early 80s band.
Yeah, I mean, they had like, before they were famous, they had a dead guitar player. They had they collaborated with George Clinton. They had charges of like. Wasn't there like a sexual assault charge in their past? Like, that was before
they were
famous?
I don't know. There was something with Flea at an MTV Beach House type taping. I think there's probably other things. I mean, that's the thing. Like, if you scratch the surface of this band at all, it gets pretty ugly pretty fast. Their sort of hedonist suit pushed it way too far, way too often. There's a lot of seriousness underneath the silliness. But yeah, there's probably stuff like that.
But to your point, they kind of had a whole career before they were famous.
Yeah, they totally did. You know, and it's a weird thing for me is like the record of theirs that I'm the closest with by far is One Hot Minute. It's the one is the next record, and it's the Dave Navarro record, and it's definitely like the black sheep of the entire catalog. And like I was in high school and I was trying to play guitar. I was taking guitar lessons at that time, and like the My Friends guitar riff, like I don't know if you remember it. Like,
oh, yeah.
That's like the perfect riff that like a high schooler thinks he can learn how to play and could like struggle with for hours and hours. And so I ended up buying that record and being much closer to that record than even the previous one or any of the others.
See, and this was another thing I appreciated about your piece is that you kind of defended One Hot Minute, or at least you talked about One Hot Minute in a somewhat respectful way, because this is another record. This was like a part of my past that I had forgotten because I bought that record as well. I liked that record at the time. You know, I was a Jane's Addiction fan, so I was excited about Dave Navarro joining the Chili Peppers. And I was talking to the producer of the show the other day about this, that like My Friends, that song you were playing on the guitar, I believe that was the first single from the record. And I really liked that song. But like for years afterward, I would hear the opening guitar of that song, or what I thought was the opening guitar of that song, but it sounds just like What It's Like by Everlast.
Oh, totally.
So they sound the same. So I would always be hoping for My Friends, and it was always What It's Like. And for a while, I was like, after that, I realized, like, well, no one's going to play the single from One Hot Minute anymore. Like, why am
Probably
I still expecting
not.
The single from One Hot Minute? Of course it's going to be Everlast. So... That was like my blue balls with modern rock radio, I guess, in the late 90s, wanting One Hot Minute shout-outs well past that album cycle, like when anyone would care. You know, you've kind of answered this question already, but, you know, my thing with the Chili Peppers, the thing that, like, haunts me about them is, like, why is this the band that's become, in a way, like, the legacy band of the 90s? You know, because... I mean, yeah, Pearl Jam is still around, of course, and you have the Foo Fighters and Smashing Pumpkins are around in some sort of form. But like, if you had asked me in like 1993, you know, what bands are going to be remembered in 20 years? Like, I would not have had the Chili Peppers in my top 10. But yet, this band, you know, they're continuing to put out new records. They continue to have a lot of songs on rock radio. I mean.
Yeah.
They still have a presence there, and they are sort of treated as, you know, it's like them and the Foo Fighters and I guess maybe Green Day, and there's a lot of Pumpkin songs still on the radio. I mean, they seem to be like one of the emblematic bands. I mean, is it just because they have this sort of weird survivalist thing? Like they're like a cockroach in a way of like 90s rock that you can't kill them no matter what?
They have just sort of cheerfully kept plugging away at it. You know, in a way that Smashing Pumpkins, Pearl Jam, and all those other bands, like, they kept touring and kept releasing records. But again, there was always this sort of fraught, self-negating aspect to it, where they were clearly struggling with how big they'd gotten or how small they'd comparatively gotten, and just always dissatisfied with their place in the world, whether they were on top of the world, you know, see Pearl Jam, or, you know, sliding down as the, you know, Smashing Pumpkins, you know, just... struggling with their legacies, both positive and negative. You know, the Red Hot Chili Peppers just don't seem bothered by that stuff. You know, like they have super convoluted lineup issues. And the one thing I said in the piece, like, I wasn't trolling, you know, but I figured people who are really into the band would be aghast. Like, the other thing is, you know, I listened to all 11 of their records, you know, in chronological order, and that's the only one where the person playing guitar really mattered to me, really stood out to me. You know, I think of this band and I think of Flea, you know, who I think is universally sort of beloved. And I think of Anthony Kiedis, who is, you know, polarizing, but like distinct, like, you know what he sounds like. Like that's the Red Hot Chili Peppers to me, you know, and you can picture the guitar and, you know, it's funky and it's noodly or whatever, but like the way that John Frusciante is sort of, join the band and quit the band and back again so many times, like, it's it never really mattered that much to me, you know, but it's just in comments to the story in Twitter or whatever, there was a high enough volume of people sort of aghast at that and sort of pleasant enough about it that, like, they were just trying to sell you on, like, John Frusciante is like the one true pairing of this, well, of this band, and it's not the same without him. And these last two records, including the new one that they've done with Josh Klinghoffer, who doesn't have, you know, much of a resume beyond this band, like, they're trying to sell it like this is a different kind of thing, and it's just, it's not the same. Like, it's okay and it's fine, but it's totally not the same. And, like, the pure essence of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you have to go back to the Frusciante stuff, like Blood Sugar Sex Magik, obviously, but, like, the records after, you know, Californication. And like, so I went back and I listened to the last Frusciante record, which unfortunately was Stadium Arcadium,
right,
which is dead ass 2 hours long. It is a double album, and it's just, it's sort of this overwhelming and numbing, you know, on principle. But, like, I tried to listen to it and just isolate the guitar, and it is incredibly impressive in just how diffuse it is. Like, it sounds like 50 different people playing guitar. Like, it's a different person every second. Like, sometimes he's really frantic and sometimes he's, like, laid back to the point of comatose. Like, it's the range of it is really impressive, and sort of sold me on the idea that, like, this is a band that's gone through a bunch of phases and has survived improbably and has been fairly cheerful about it, but, like, they're not their true selves anymore.
Yeah. Well, and I have to say, before we, because I do want to talk about the new record with you, but I do have to respond to this Frusciante slander here, because I can't believe that this is, like, the closest thing I have to a passionate Chili Peppers opinion, but I do think that John Frusciante is the, he's not the most important element, but he's sort of like, you know, like, if I'm going to make a car analogy, even though I don't know anything about cars, but, like, if you took,
okay,
like if you took, like, one of the chargers, like, off the car battery or something, like, you like, the battery is the important thing, but if it's not hooked up properly, the car doesn't run. And he's sort of like the connectors on the car that connect the battery to the car. Like, I really think that, like, if you look at their career, like, Hillel Slovak, I think, was their first guitar player, and he passed away. And then, yeah, Frusciante joined with Mother's Milk, and then he was on Blood Sugar Sex Magik, and then he rejoined with Californication. I do feel like, at least in the minds of fans, that, like, without him, for some reason, it doesn't count. Like, there's something about the classic lineup that people associate with the band that's important. And I also think that he has a certain guitar tone that, to me, is very distinctively Chili Peppers. It's sort of like a trebly, dry, almost,
right,
chicken scratchy type sound, whereas, as opposed to, like, Dave Navarro, who's sort of like a, you know, like a, he was like a, like the Jimmy Page of alt rock, you know, like, very busy.
Oh, he's hilarious.
And huge. But, like, you know, like, in your piece, you talk about the guitar solo on I Could Have Lied from Blood Sugar,
yeah,
Sex Magik. Like, to me, that's like something that there's something very distinctively Frusciantean. I'm going to say Frusciantean, if that as an,
sure,
adjective, about,
please,
that. And even, like, with those Californication songs, like, just the sound of the guitar on those, I think there,
yeah,
was something about that brought the band back. At least it signaled to people that, oh, this is the real Chili Peppers after that Dave Navarro experiment that no one liked. Like, now we're back, and you can,
yeah,
take us. And people embrace them for that. Like, my theory with the Chili Peppers, I liken them to Aerosmith in the arc of their career, and that, you know, just like how Aerosmith in the 70s, they had this first decade where they were this, you know, popular band, and then they burned out on drugs by the end of the 70s. Sort of like, it's basically what happened to the Chili Peppers. Like, after Blood Sugar Sex Magik, they do One Hot Minute, and then there's, like, several years between records, and they seem to have, at that point, if they were going to break up, that was probably the time they were going to do it. And then,
yeah,
they reinvent themselves as this power ballad band. You know, like, that's how they get back on the charts. They, you know, Permanent Vacation has Angel, Pump has What It Takes, and Janie's Got a Gun. And then by Get a Grip era, they're just doing power ballads all the time, and they all sound alike.
Yeah.
Crazy, Amazing, and what's the other one? Crazy, Amazing, and Crying.
Crying.
And I feel like that's what the Chili Peppers did. Like, a lot of those Californication songs are all these mid-tempo ballads,
yeah,
about heroin and California and whatever. And that's,
right,
how they got back on the radio. And I feel like that's why maybe, like, they were able to sort of downshift into that, into this sort of, I think you say something in there about like the warrior poet type thing, like these serious meditations on it, because like it seems like their post 90s stuff in general has been getting less and less party oriented and more oriented to these sort of sad ballads type stuff. And this is a good segue to talk about the new record, The Getaway. And, you know, look, I haven't been a working music critic like this half of the year. So like I've been able to avoid records that I didn't really care about. So I didn't listen to this until I knew I was going to be talking to you. And, man, that song, The Hunter, there's a song on this record called The Hunter, which is a piano ballad.
Yep.
And like, I knew Elton John was on this record. I assume Elton John was on this song because it sounds kind of like an Elton John ballad, but he's on a song called Sick Love.
Yeah.
So Elton doesn't play on the piano ballad, but this song has my favorite bad lyric on the record, where Anthony Kiedis sings, "Time just gets its way, strawberries left to decay."
It's poignant, isn't it?
It's like, you know, it's weird that, because, you know, like Rick Rubin has been their guy, I think, since Sex Magic. It's weird that he didn't produce this record, because that's kind of his specialty, you know, is doing these like records by middle-aged artists who like meditate on mortality and death.
Yeah,
and
the Johnny Cash stuff and all.
And like, you know, even Neil Diamond made a serious record under Rick Rubin's tutelage. Like, I mean, what's going on with the Chili Peppers? Are they just kind of slowly? I mean, like an aging Chili Peppers, like what is the point of this record? Like who wants this record in 2016? Is there like an audience out there that demands this kind of record?
I mean, probably not, but I think this is just them plugging away. It's just, that's what you do. You're a band, you make an album, you know, you tour, you play three songs off that album, and then you play like the 15 bulletproof hits, you know, some of them decades old that everybody loves and prefers, you know, like there's no way this is going to be anybody's favorite Peppers record. My favorite lyric on it is, I don't remember it exactly, but it's something like a girl too young to be my wife. You know, like the supposed narrative of the record is it's a breakup record of Anthony Kiedis breaking up with his literally like early 20s girlfriend, you know, and Anthony Kiedis is what, like 50 plus at this point. Like the dissonance there is almost kind of sweet.
I was going to say that, like, but it's, like a woman too young to be his wife would be like 35.
Exactly. Yeah.
like that's too young to be his wife at this point. But yeah. Anyway, yeah, continue.
Well, it's just sort of bizarre that, you know, the Californication age was them sort of looking back at their debaucherous past, you know, and being wizened and regretful, you know, but still hopeful for the future. But like we're now a full decade beyond that. Like you can't really double down on being sort of tired, you know, and reflective, you know, when you already spent a decade doing that. And so the thing with Frusciante is like I agree that his tone is super singular, and like I, as a high school kid, I tried to play the I Could Have Lied solo as well, and like that went very poorly. Obviously, like I think I can do it on Rock Band now, which is cool, but which is not quite the same thing. But I guess like for me, like Josh Klinghoffer can sort of ape that tone enough where you don't, if you're not a super fan and you're not listening super closely to the guitar, like you don't really miss him. Like again, like I just sort of cling to Flea in these situations, and Flea is still Flea. You know, the bass lines are still great. Like his chemistry with the drummer, Chad Smith, is still great. Like there's enough of the core proposition there to sort of pull you through, you know, a sort of snoozy, exhausted sounding hour long record, you know, and like, there's enough goodwill there to sort of will the thing into existence. But like the question of why it exists, like, yeah, just cause that's what you do. You know, the thing that all their alt-rock sort of adversaries sort of refused to do, which was just make records just to make records and keep plugging away at it, you know? Like, that's what the Red Hot Chili Peppers do. They put out a record now every half decade. You know, there's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of lineup changes, you know, like Flea breaks his arm snowboarding and so forth. Like, there's minor there's minor middle age turmoil to it, but you know, it's just they're chill. Like, they're a multimillionaire, you know, 20 something girl dating, you know, playboys who are, you know, a little sad about not being in the prime of their lives anymore, but generally pleased with their place in the universe, you know. And it's I can't really begrudge them wanting to make, you know, a Harry Nilsson record or whatever they're trying to do here. But yeah, like, this isn't going to rank high even for super fans, you know, even in retrospect.
Yeah, I mean, this, I wanted to bridge this kind of Chili Peppers conversation to something that you sort of hint at in this piece, and I feel like you've maybe hinted at in some other recent pieces, which is about sort of the transition phase of classic rock that we're going through right now. This idea that, like, this 90s generation of bands is the new classic rock.
Yeah.
And just how the hierarchies of that shake out. It's interesting. I feel like I've had this discussion with very, like, the people that care about classic rock radio. You know, the people who actually think about these things. And I know, like I've known people who look at classic rock as being a very distinct thing, that it means 60s and 70s rock. It means, you know, mixing The Who and Styx and Boston and all those bands. And they've been, and they're resistant to the 90s being grouped in with that. What are do you have an opinion on that? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the worst thing of all is the phenomenon. Like, think about the Mike Watt song Against the 70s. Like, whenever that song came out, we were closer to the 70s than we are now to the song Against the 70s. Like, you, the realization of how much time has passed and, like, how old, like, all the 90s greats, those records are now compared to, like the 90s or the 60s of the 90s. You know what I mean? And this is just what happens. And another prism is just the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that now those guys are starting to induct, you know, Green Day and Pearl Jam and Nine Inch Nails and Smashing Pumpkins, you know, and once they get to Radiohead, you know, once they get to the Strokes, you know, they're going to run out of bands, you know. Are they going to induct the Kings of Leon? Like, it's not a renewable resource, you know, the way you maybe thought it would be in the prime of all those bands. Like, it's, you know, this record, this new Red Hot Chili Peppers record is produced by Danger Mouse, who to me is like the guy you go to when you're like a bored rock band that needs like a jolt. Like, the Black Keys did it, and the dude from the Shins did it with that side project. And like, he's sort of the guy who can raise you from the dead for a brief period. And it's to watch all these rock bands now sort of try and keep at it and try and keep going, like the ones as old as the Peppers and the ones who are younger, like, I don't know, Death Cab for Cutie, like, it's, things are really slowing down, and like, all these distinctions are collapsing, and then all the grunge stuff, all the 90s stuff is starting to collapse into the 80s, into the 70s. Like, it's just the one great big morass of just like old.
Right.
You know, like, I don't, it's for 20 something people today, like, what do you think about the Red Hot Chili Peppers? Do you know them as, you know them as the Californication people? You know, like, you're shocked that they had a career before then, the same way I'm shocked that they had a career before Blood Sugar Sex Magik. Like, this is unfortunately what happens, Steve, you know.
Well, you know,
they get old and we get older, even older.
And I find this fascinating because it's something that, you know, as you say, it's something that is happening constantly, but this is a specific area that I've witnessed myself and I've watched it happen. So it's a fascinating thing to observe. And I'm with you. I feel like, well, first of all, the term classic rock was invented by radio programmers who were trying to appeal to a certain segment of the audience, basically men between the ages of, like, you know, 30 and 50 or something. And
dads,
basically. And now those people, you know, that audience is now the audience that grew up with 90s rock. So it's sort of inevitable that that is going to be integrated into the body. But, like, I just want to read you this thing, you know, because just as a counterpoint, you know, the sort of dissonance maybe that happens when these shifts occur. My friend Jason Heller wrote something about this, like, back in 2011, so 5 years ago already. And he was complaining about hearing 90s acts on classic rock radio. And he wrote, you know, this isn't a qualitative issue. It's purely emotional. Classic rock serves a specific purpose in my life, nostalgia. Given that I turned 18 in 1990, the nostalgia I feel for the 70s and 80s is vastly different from the nostalgia I feel for the 90s. When it comes to mainstream rock, maybe the 90s were better than previous decades. Not that I could imagine a convincing argument to that effect, but that isn't the point. By nature, the classic rock format is frozen in time, or at least it should be. It isn't meant to progress or evolve. It's a snapshot of a tableau, one in which the grit of Lynyrd Skynyrd mixes with the atmosphere of Pink Floyd, where Roger Daltrey and Robert Plant are the pastors of megachurches, where the cool hum of the Cars and Dire Straits coexist with the nerdy complexity of Rush, and yes, where rock and roll, even when it gets brainy, has yet to construct itself at a foot-shuffling, self-negating level. Now, the end part there is a shot at 90s music, which he viewed as sort of being like a kind of like a post-Empire ironic kind of remix of classic rock history. What I find interesting about this is how the further you get away from something, the less distinctions matter in terms of either genres or, you know, scenes that might have existed. So, for instance, Nirvana to someone who was born in 1995 probably doesn't seem that much different than Pink Floyd or Rush.
Right.
It's all part of the same soup.
Well, I guess that's the question, is if you want to listen to classic rock radio and you turn that on, like, do you want to hear another Brick in the Wall part two for the 50 billionth time, or do you want to hear Jeremy by Pearl Jam, which is like a breath of fresh air, but also like a horrifying sort of realization for you to have as a person that, like, you know, again, that song is as old now as another Brick in the Wall was when Jeremy came out. Like, it's shocking. You know, and it's for classic rock to evolve requires you to age and eventually die,
right?
Basically, and so you make your choice.
See, what I find, I find interesting in these shifts is like what bands end up coming out on top, and the Red Hot Chili Peppers being an example that, like, they were not a band that I would have predicted being a because like now, if you are listening to the radio and you want to learn about the 90s and you're going to learn about it through the radio, like the Chili Peppers now are going to seem like an emblematic band. I guess in a way, too, that like when we were growing up, it's like you heard Grand Funk Railroad on the radio and not the New York Dolls, you know, so you're going to like feel like if you only listen to the radio, you're going to be like, well, I've never heard of the New York Dolls, but I know five Grand Funk Railroad songs. And that ends up kind of shaping your perception of things. One band I wanted to bring up in the context of this is a band that also has a new record coming out, which is Blink 182. And this is another band that like has gone through lineup changes. Like Tom DeLonge was in the band for a long time, and now he's out of the band because he's investigating UFOs. And doing crazy things, and now they have Matt Skiba. I don't know. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Skiba or Skiba? My producer gave me the thumb.
He's gonna be mad if you didn't.
Yeah, my producer gave me the thumbs up.
Okay, good.
And they're an example of a band that, you know, was popular in the late 90s into the early 2000s. And like when they were popular at the time, like I didn't relate to them at all. Like I thought, I sort of turned my nose up at them. But now I've come to like love a lot of those kind of classic era Blink 182 songs. But you know, now when I look at them, and I also see other bands that are operating now, like younger bands, like especially in the punk and emo scene, I wonder, like, is Blink 182 like at least as influential as Nirvana, or as important as Nirvana? Like, I feel like that seems like sacrilege in some way, maybe. But I also feel increasingly like that might be true.
Well, it might have been your podcast, Steve, actually, where I learned that the dude from The Hotelier, who is, I think, my favorite current rock band.
Yeah.
Like, his favorite record, rock record, was Enema of the State, was Blink 182's. You know, and so I think you're onto something there. I mean, it might be lame, but I think my favorite Blink song is still "What's My Age Again,"
right?
Which came out whenever it came out. Was it like the early 2000s?
It was like late 90s, I think.
Okay, and so they're another band that's been publicly struggling with aging or not aging or maturing or not maturing, you know, for 20 years now, you know, and they've got, you know, bizarre sort of lineup issues, and they're still plugging away. Like, I'm excited for this new record, you know, like I, the singles have been pretty good. And like, I'm sort of ready. I think they're ripe to be sort of reevaluated along these lines, you know, and part of it, like the Peppers, is just you show up, you know, how you become enduring and how you come to define the eras that your band was active is it like you keep putting out records, you know, even if not all of them are great, even if not all of them come to be themselves emblematic of the scene, like you just, you're always there, you know, and you, there's no telling who you're going to influence or which of your records are going to be end up held in the same sort of biblical sort of formative esteem as Nevermind. And I do think that's happening with Blink, you know, for a lot of the bands that I really like now, like that you've talked to on this podcast, you know, like Pump, I think is an example, and I'm blanking on the others right now.
But like Modern Baseball, I feel like.
Modern Baseball is a big one. Yeah, like that's, I think Blink is a template for a lot of that stuff, for both good and ill, mostly good, you know? And so it's, I think that definitely happened.
Well, I was going to say, like, you know, showing up is a big thing. I also feel like, you know, we made the, I was sort of joking about this earlier, but like how Red Hot Chili Peppers, Blood Sugar Sex Magik was like a sleepover classic, you know, when it was about that. Those records that people listen to at sleepovers when they're 13 and 14 end up sort of becoming way more important 10 years later when those people grow up. And, you know, and those records that maybe weren't taken, and in a way they become more important because maybe they were dismissed in their day. So like when those people grow up, they're sort of reacting against older people who told them that their band sucked. So they're going to even wave the flag more, you know, in favor of that. And I feel like I've definitely seen that with Blink 182, which, again, I think at the time, you know, maybe like an older music critic or something would have just assumed that they'd have a couple albums that were popular and then disappear. You know, there wouldn't have been an idea that they would still be touring in their 40s, you know, or they might even be approaching their 50s at this point. I'm not sure how old Mark Hoppus is. But, you know, it, I mean, do you have any feelings about this? Is there, you know, obviously this is the way things are. It's evolution. It's the changing of generations. Is there any weirdness with this? Like where you're like, why this band? Like, why does this exist? Or are you just accepting of it? Do you like, well, this is the way it is.
I'd like to think I'm at peace mostly. It's like Weezer, you know?
And oh, yeah.
I loved Weezer when Weezer came out, and I sat by my radio with my hand on the record button trying to get the Sweater song, like, when it came on the radio. And it took, like, 2 weeks or whatever, but Weezer were not a critically respected band, you know? Like, the Pinkerton stuff is legendary at this point. But I think Weezer is another example of a band that didn't get the respect they were due at the time, but like over the course of the last 20 years, you know, the cult has grown and grown to now they're like an obvious logical formative influence for like most of the best young rock bands now, in my opinion. Like that's just sort of the way that it happens. You know, it's never quite the ones you think that are going to define the era that end up defining the era, you know? And I'm just excited that people are still making music like that at all. And when I listen to it, I have this vague sense that I'm being like directly pandered to, and like it's totally obvious and kind of sad that I love this, you know, because it reminds me of the music of when I was a kid, and you know, and that's I should be seeking out, like I don't even know what I should be seeking out, but it's the fact that it's comfort food for me now and maybe for you now, like I don't know if I even need to be ashamed of that, you know, and I'm mostly not, but kind of am, but I'd like to think that I'm at peace with it, you know, that this is just the way it happens. Like, I went to see Guns N' Roses in concert last week, and Guns N' Roses, the opening act was Alice in Chains. Like, I have this weirdly vivid memory of some documentary or something where the Janie Lane of Warrant is talking about when he knew it was over, when he knew that hair metal, when he knew that the 80s were over and he was done, which was when, like, he would visit his record label and it would always be a Warrant album, you know, blown up the cover on the wall of, you know, the office walls. And he walks in one time and it's Alice in Chains and it's Dirt. You know, he realizes that grunge is here, alternative is here, Kurt Cobain is here, and, like, they're blowing up the whole hair metal thing, you know, and it's over. You know, it's a hard break between those two. The opening act for Guns N' Roses was Alice in Chains. You know, and it was right. And they were fantastic. And like the crowd loved them just as they loved the Guns N' Roses. And like it made total logical sense. Like that, what was once a very firm divide, and like one killed the other, it now all just bleeds together. You know, and some combination of the best stuff and the most prominent stuff survives. You know, and huddles together for warmth. You know, and I'm actually totally fine with that.
Yeah,
most of the time.
And you mentioned about like the comfort food thing. I do feel like that is where the evolution happens, that these things collapse into each other. Like when I interviewed Pup,
yes.
we talked about punk, but we also talked about Van Halen. You know, and there was a time
right.
where you would have had to choose sides on that divide. But
yeah.
they're able to merge that in a way that I think is uniquely now. I mean, I feel like with rock music, you know, you can put it on a pop paradigm where pop music is constantly reinventing itself. And if you
yeah.
aren't doing that, then somehow you're not as valuable. But I feel like right. rock is a blues-based music, and blues is about carrying a tradition forward, and there's value in that. So
yeah.
I don't think you can, you know, that would be my argument, I guess, about that sort
yeah.
of thing having value. But to circle back to what you were saying about Guns N' Roses, because I did want to talk to you about this, because you did write about seeing the tour opening. And just to be quick, because you wrote about seeing the tour open in Detroit. And the thing about your piece that was uncanny is that you sort of refuted every justification I had in my mind not to spend money on this tour. Because when this tour was announced, I love Guns N' Roses. You know, they were one of the first rock bands that I ever loved. And this was
Same
a tour. Yeah, this would have been a tour that I would have been really excited about. But I just felt like, of all the bands that I love, this is a band that you had to see when they were young. Really translate. I was like, do I want to see Fat Axl Rose sucking wind in between
right.
verses of Welcome to the Jungle? It's like, I don't know if I want to do that. But so I've talked about this on other episodes, being openly skeptical of Axl Rose in 2016. But I have to say, the clips I've seen of him with AC/DC, surprisingly good, or at least
yeah.
maybe my expectations were low and he exceeded them. I don't know. And then your review, you said that they delivered and they actually showed up on time. They played well. Axl sounded good. And
yeah.
I'm like, is Rob going to make me see Guns N' Roses on this tour?
Oh, man, I don't know if I want that response.
No, you're on the hook, buddy. You wrote this. I'm blaming you if I go to the show. If I spend like $150 on a Guns N' Roses ticket, it's on you. So
yeah, I'll Venmo you. You know, the proceeds. It was totally about low expectations for me. Like, I don't mean this ugly, but I thought it was going to be awful. You know, and that's not because I thought they were going to try really hard and be bad. I thought they weren't going to try at all. Like it's. If you everything that you know that you've read about that you remember about Guns N' Roses is like their total contempt for the audience, like all the riots, you know, and
right.
Axl showing up at like 4:30 in the morning and whatever, and like I just pictured the five of them like on Barca loungers on stage, like counting their money with like Chinese democracy playing over the PA, like the notion that like they would show up on time and like open with It's So Easy, which is my favorite Guns N' Roses song, and like play for 2.5 hours, like everything that you want to hear, and be like nice and wave goodbye and then leave. Like it was both awesome and like sort of shockingly unlike them, or unlike, you know, the memory that I had of them, or like the myth that, you know, they created for themselves. And I sort of hesitate. I try not to like make fun of people's physical appearance, obviously, but like Axl is old. Like Axl is up there, and like these guys are sort of fundamentally dirtbags in a way that like I feel less bad about getting into that with them, maybe. But like what I'll say about Axl is like he's well managed. Like he took a lot of breaks. Like he would just go backstage. Like I just sort of picture him like just sucking on like a pure oxygen tank and like being like blown back up, you know, like a parade float, and then going out there and like, but he does not shy away from anything. Like even, you know, the sort of high notes and the histrionic stuff that you remember, like the end of Don't Cry or like You Could Be Mine or the, you know, the end of Sweet Child of Mine, like the studio versions were probably pretty heavily doctored to begin with. Like I didn't see them live in their prime and I couldn't compare, but like, he's not somebody like, you know, you go and you see 30-year-old bands and like they're playing you know, like very slow, very modest versions of their hits. You know, you think of like Layla, like it's the acoustic version of the unplugged version of Layla versus the actual version of Layla. Like, you know, there's a downshifting that happens there. And like Axl Rose has been trying to do that, you know, and whether he's hitting those notes, you know, and he's holding his breath for as long as he could in his prime, like obviously not, but like there's an effort there that's sort of genuinely, again, sort of shocking in the context of like this band and like what a bunch of fuck ups and, you know, they historically have been. Like it's a show, man. It's a 2.5 hour show where like everybody is giving like their version at least of 100%. And I sort of say in the piece, it's like, I really hope that this tour continues, but like it just seems really unlikely and really unlike them to like announce a tour and play the shows on that tour and like satisfy people. Like, you know, there's like there's an article today, I think in the Riverfront Times, like an oral history of the riot at the show in St. Louis, you know, and in Primera Guns N' Roses. And there's the one in Canada, I think, where Axl like fucked something up and then Metallica played, and that's when James Hetfield got burned up.
Yeah,
by the pyro thing or whatever. Like there's so many disasters in the history of Guns N' Roses, to say nothing of Chinese Democracy, like the arc there in full. Like it's just so unlike them to just be pros and to just go out there and do it and give the people what they want. But like, that's at least for now, that's what they're doing.
Well, see, and I wonder, you know,
and it was pretty awesome.
Like, I wonder if bands have just, and I don't know what the right word would be, if it's smarter or cannier, or maybe they've just sort of given in, but it seems like bands are much more sort of ready to give people what they want, like those sort of reunion bands, or legacy acts. Like, I mean, we were just kind of talking about the Chili Peppers record. That's not so much in their wheelhouse, but I think of like the Weezer record that came out this year. Like, that's pretty much a record that like answers all the complaints that old school fans had about the band. Like, they kind of, like Rivers Cuomo, where the lover hated what he did, he was for a while trying to engage with modern pop music. And then he stopped that and he made sort of a classic sounding Weezer record. You know, Radiohead on their latest record, they kind of got away from doing the more sort of electronic stuff and they made a record that was more in the vein of like their classic sounding stuff.
Right.
And, you know, like Van Halen, they finally, you know, mended fences with David Lee Roth and brought him in. And it's like, okay, we're going to do this. And you have bands playing entire records. Like their most popular records are like, okay, we're just going to play this record. And we know you guys like that the most. I just wonder if, you know, because I feel, because no matter what you want to say about Chinese Democracy, like that record is a mess and it's crazy. But like, it was Axl trying to do something different and reinvent Guns N' Roses. Right. And like on an artistic level, you could justify it in that way and say like, well, you know, he's pushing the music forward. Whereas now there is maybe, I don't know if you want to call it resignation or greed or whatever, like this realization that if I get back together with these guys who have not had a relationship for 20 years, you know, we're going to be able to tour and make a lot of money. I mean, like our bands just, I mean, is this a good thing that they're doing? Cause like in a way I'm glad they're doing this, but is there also like a thing, like it just seems less adventurous maybe. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm talking myself out of liking things that I like, because I like all these things. I wouldn't want Axl to tour with Buckethead. I like that he's back with Slash.
Right, yeah.
But there is a part of me that's like, well, is it getting back to the pandering thing where it's like, okay, we're going to, because this is the era of fan service. You know, we listen to fans now. Is this just another version of fan service in a way?
Well, there's a pandering spectrum. You know, the answer, like, the festival circuit now, you know, the reality that Coachella and the like need like major reunions every year to survive. Like, this is the time to do that. Like, in every other respect, sonically or whatever, like this comparison doesn't work at all. But like, Outkast had that summer where this is a group where like it's so obvious that they do not want to do this. They do not want to engage in their past. They want to move forward and forget any of it ever happened. But like, they played like 12 billion festivals across the country over the course of 3 months, you know, and like gave everyone what they wanted, because I'm sure the money was just unreal, you know, and now it's done. Like they're done with it. And it's, you know, the Weezer, the last two Weezer records are better than the previous two Weezer records, you know, in some cases going back to your roots, I think could be a good thing. It could be an honest thing. And It's not about, you know, not experimenting or being true to yourself. Like, this is being true to yourself.
Right.
You know, it's, and I, one of the best shows I've seen this year was Smashing Pumpkins. It was billed in some Byzantine sort of way as Billy Corgan, you know, acoustic and completely reimagining his songs. And like, he did a lot of acoustic stuff and a lot of futzing around, but like, he also had Jimmy Chamberlain on stage, you know. He also did like half of Siamese Dream, you know, and like all the other melancholy songs or whatever that you'd want to hear from Smashing Pumpkins. Like, that to me was the platonic ideal of giving people what they wanted in terms of what the set list is, but like twisting it just enough. Like, it's not like he's doing like trip hop versions of these songs or whatever, but it's just enough of a spin where if you're Billy Corgan, you can justify to yourself going back to that well, you know, and you can also cash the check of, you know, selling out, you know, an X thousand seat theater because, you know, people want to hear Today. You know, and
right.
You'll play Today for them, you know, in the midst of 30 plus songs, some of which they know, some of which they don't, you know, so there's a spectrum there. And I think, you know, this sort of the festival overload era, you know, gives bands a chance to just totally indulge in the past and just go out and do it. Like, I saw At the Drive-In, you know, play in a parking lot in where I live here in Columbus, Ohio, you know, and they just did Ship of Command songs like that, and that album is fantastic, you know. And like At the Drive-In totally splintered, and they started the Mars Volta, and they clearly almost pretty much denounced their past. And like, I think they played Coachella a couple years ago, and like,
yeah,
they've done a reunion, but it's been like extremely grudging, you know. It's just like, we don't want to do this, but the money's too good and we can hardly stand each other, but like, here, like, just take it, you know. But like, it was a fantastic show, like, for whatever, for that 45 minutes, you know, and they, you know, they were energetic about it. They seemed to have come to peace with the fact that, like, you know, people are still interested in this, and there's no harm in indulging in that for a little bit, you know. And their set ended, and then the Red Hot Chili Peppers played, like, 2 hours later. Like, it all just moves towards the middle.
Yep.
And sometimes for bad, but sometimes it works out all right.
Well, you know, you brought it back to the start so well there that I think we have to wrap up. We're not going to, you know, you tied it in a bow so well.
That's what I do.
And the band they were playing with was the Red Hot Chili Peppers. Now you know the rest of the story.
Oh, God.
Well, hey, Rob, this was a lot of fun, man. I'm glad we got an excuse to talk. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, and definitely want to have you on again sometime.
Absolutely.
All right, man, take care.
Thanks. See you.
All right, that was Rob Harvella talking deep about the Chili Peppers. We went deep into the Chili Peppers discography on this podcast. You cannot say that this is not a diverse podcast in terms of covering the full spectrum of rock, although I'm pretty sure we probably will not talk about the Chili Peppers again. But who knows? They might come up. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It's been great, as always. And if you're a fan of the podcast, it would be awesome if you could help us spread the word, whether that is leaving a review on iTunes for us, or talking about us on social media, or even just telling a friend that this is a fun podcast to listen to and to learn about new music. I also want to mention my book, Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me. It is still on sale at your neighborhood bookstore or at your favorite online retailer. I'd love it if you check that out. Also, one more shout out to our sponsor for this week's episode, Mack Weldon. Again, Mack Weldon is offering a great deal for Celebration Rock Pod listeners. If you go to mackweldon.com and enter in the promo code ROCK, you will get 20% off of your order. So definitely go and do that right away. Thanks again, guys. It's been great chatting at you, and we'll be back again next week.